Hello and welcome to the American Writers Museum Author Talks podcast, where we bring the power of the written word straight to your ears. This week we chat with Catherine Schweit, the former head of the FBI's active shooter program and author of the recent book, Stop the Killing, How to End the Mass Shooting Crisis. Schweit is interviewed by Chad Riley, a member of the Chicago Council of the AWM. This conversation originally took place March 31st, 2022, and was recorded live at the American Writers Museum. We hope you enjoy entering the mind of a writer.
Good evening, everyone, and thank you for joining us here tonight in the American Writers Museum. Those of you who are here live, and also those of you who are here online, for this author talk with Catherine Schweit, author of Stop the Killing, How to End the Mass Shooting Crisis. This event is hosted by the Chicago Council, and my name is Chad Riley. I'm a former president and current member of the American Writers Museum Chicago Council. And for those of you who are unaware, the Chicago Council is essentially a board of established professionals whose sole job it is to be an ambassador of the museum, help raise awareness both locally and nationally, and also raise mission critical funds for the museum and our education initiatives. So I'm very excited to be here tonight with Catherine, or Kate, as most people call you.
They both work, yeah.
So I don't think I can give your background justice, but I'm gonna try to give a brief overview. Kate is a former prosecutor, a former FBI special agent and senior executive within the Bureau, former director of global security for Live Nation Entertainment, adjunct law professor for DePaul. I could go on and on, but really why we're here, and I think what brought about this book, is that you were tagged by the FBI to create and lead their active shooter program after Sandy Hook. So very excited to be speaking with you. So to start off, the book is absolutely fascinating. It's more than just sort of action steps and items, how we can end the mass shooting crisis, but also stories, facts, anecdotes, and a lot of dispelling of sort of common myths, a lot of preconceived notions that I had. So maybe to start off, can you talk a little bit about your background in the FBI,
sure,
creating the active shooter program, and then what brought you to ultimately write the book?
Yeah, definitely. Because when I, as an agent, when I left the prosecutor's office in Chicago and joined the FBI as an agent, I was working national security matters. But then after the Sandy Hook shooting, an agent in the FBI, and they said, "You're doing this now." And I said, "Okay." So I guess I'm kind of like the maybe some people who are listening to this now. I didn't have a massive background in this area when I started. And what happened is I was tagged with joining a White House team, then Vice President Biden's team, Department of Education, Health and Human Services, DHS, all the other three letters as we call them in Washington. And my job was to stop these shootings that were going on. And truthfully, I think what happened very quickly is in our meetings with the Vice President's office, it became very apparent that nobody really knew if the shootings were increasing. And that's kind of where the FBI started. Are the shootings increasing? And what can law enforcement do to help? And we were focused as the only Justice Department person, as the only law enforcement agency on the team, with thinking about law enforcement. And so I really spent nearly 5 years in the FBI thinking, how can the FBI help law enforcement? You know, there's nearly a million law enforcement officers in the United States. How can the FBI help law enforcement do a better job when it comes to preventing or responding or recovering from these kind of situations? But what I learned as I got further along is that there's hundreds of millions of people in the United States, and a million law enforcement officers are not going to solve this problem. So I think as I got to the end of my FBI career, I really felt, and went into private industry, I really felt that the answers needed to come from citizens, civilians, and that civilians just didn't have the information they needed. They didn't have the knowledge to know how they can stop the killing, and that's really what compelled me to write the book. I just answered the same questions over and over and over again. I would run into people, I'd go to dinner parties, I'd be at church, and somebody would ask me a question, the neighbor would ask me a question, they were all asking me the same questions. So I really kind of started out with file cards and tags of, you know, little post-it notes on my office, said, what questions do I need to answer that people just continually ask me?
Yeah, and so the research you obviously must have done for the book is immense because there's so many studies and there's so much data. So a lot of that, I'm assuming you drew on existing research, existing studies, and then obviously did a lot on your own and still continue to do that.
Well, the one thing that I think we started that, you know, I didn't expect is that we got a lot of pushback. Truthfully, I got a lot of pushback from the Department of Education about, is there an increase in shootings? And so I really felt like for us as a law enforcement agency, we needed to prove that there was an increase or disprove it. And I really felt like that fell on the FBI's shoulders to resolve. So I took a tremendously talented group of analysts and agents, and we asked local law enforcement to provide to us their actual police reports from hundreds of shootings. And we pushed all that information together and released a 14-year study that's available online that said, yeah, indeed, the shootings are increasing. And so that was really kind of the beginning of us realizing, I think, in Washington that the shootings are really increasing, and we were validating that year after year after year. And I know just a couple of years ago, the FBI released the 20-year study that shows, and when we started, I'll tell you, this is, I have too many numbers in my head, but I'll tell you that this is a horrible number. When we started, the first 7 years of the study was from 2000 to 2006. There were six incidents a year. By the time I finished that 14-year study, there were 16 incidents a year. By the time that I left the FBI, there was one incident every 8 weeks. By the time I left Live Nation, there was one incident every 4 weeks. Right now, there's one incident at least every week. Every week, there's an incident. Every week that falls, for you statisticians and analytical people, in the exact same methodology that we started with when we started back in 2002, looking at the numbers. So we've gone exponentially higher. Last year, the FBI releases these numbers every year. And when I left the FBI, when we did our final study, there were 17 incidents as the highest number in a year. In the last three years, there have been 30, 30, and 40. And I can tell you, the FBI hasn't released its numbers for this year, but they are going to shortly, and it's probably going to be about 50% higher. So this problem is not going away. We have to find a way to fix it. We can't manage it. We have to find a way to fix it.
Yeah, and so you bring up something interesting about the trends, which I do want to address, but first I got to ask, which may be a burning question for a lot of people. I know it was for me when I first met you. When I heard the subject matter, the first thing that popped into my mind is, how is she going to address the gun debate? You know, which side does she fall on? There's a big entrenched gun culture in this country. Obviously, it's sure. Embedded Second Amendment in the Constitution, and there's a very big anti-gun culture. So how do you, like, you know, which side of the fence are you going to sit on? And you don't. You speak to everyone without kind of getting mired in that debate. And so
it's not,
talk to people about that.
Yeah, absolutely. Because, you know, the guns is the first answer that I hear from everybody. And I do a podcast now also called Stop the Killing with my co-host who's in London, Sarah Ferris. And the very first question that Sarah asked me, she tracked me down and she said, I want to do a podcast with you. And I told her no, because I didn't have time. And then she hounded me until I decided to do a podcast. And I only tell you that because that's exactly how she would describe it. And so she said right away, she's just like, well, you could solve all this problem with getting rid of the guns in the United States. And I said, well, my job is to work on realistic problem solving. And I actually, here in Chicago, I teach a class on this culture of the Second Amendment. So I'm very familiar with the issues that have to do with the Second Amendment. And how they ebb and flow. And this issue is, even though there are plenty of people who want to argue guns and who want to argue politics, this issue is an apolitical issue. Guns is an apolitical issue when it comes to mass shootings. And one of the reasons I would suggest that is, last year before, there were 47,000 firearms deaths in the United States, 47,000, roughly. Two-thirds of those were suicides. If 40 of those were incidents like this, the Second Amendment and gun issues is not about mass shootings. Mass shootings make up a very small amount of the shootings and the deaths in the United States, whether they're by suicide or violence. But mass shootings kill our psyche. That's the terrorism aspect of it. They are so damaging to us, and they make us afraid to go to school. They make us afraid to let our kid go to the movies. And then every time something happens, every time a shooting happens, there was a shooting today at a middle school in South Carolina, Greenville, South Carolina. A 12-year-old came to school with a gun and killed a 12-year-old. That is not about whether or not we have guns in the United States. That is not about whether you support gun control or you oppose gun control, or whether you support licensing or registering guns or not. That is about a 12-year-old getting a gun in their own hands. So that's about, is the gun properly secured? I raised two wonderful kids, 20 years in the FBI, carried all kinds of firearms, long guns, rifles, handguns. I secured my guns. A third of the guns in the United States are not secured. That's not about whether or not the Second Amendment supports, you know, whether or not you should support the Second Amendment. That's about, guns is just about the gun aspect of it, which is a chapter in the book on. And I was hesitant to write that because I didn't want people to think it was all about guns, but I did put a gun chapter in there because I think you need to understand the culture of guns in the United States. You need to understand the history of why we have guns. It's easy for people, you know, the podcast has listeners in New Zealand and UK and other places, and people say, well, it's all about the guns. Well, you know, it isn't all about the guns, because in the United States, we have a Second Amendment that allows guns. And if my whole solution is we're going to get rid of the guns, then I'm it's a non-starter. And so that's really where I come from. It is, there are so many other things that can be done. And when you say it's just this or it's just that, you're not looking at the real solutions, I think.
Yeah. And in that same chapter, I mean, I think you talked a lot about, and when people look at gun violence, they think mental health or it's guns, it's mental health, right? And it's guns. And you said it's a lot more multifaceted than just that. Mm-hmm. But you also talked about, if you're going to arm someone and you're going to use guns, there's certain factors. If you're going to, you know, if you're thinking about arming teachers or people who say, you know, I need to have a gun to protect myself in that kind of situation. And the stats say that, you know, actually people who don't have guns or tackle people are preventing more violence. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, the research that we did, and there were actually the initial research that we did at the FBI, and you know, one of the reasons why I have these things here and I hold them up, and one of the reasons why I wrote the book, you talked about that earlier, you know, look at these publications, FBI, American Association of Threat Assessment Professionals, the Journal for Threat Assessment Management. You guys aren't hanging out with these in your tabletops, right? I mean, that's, you know, these are not the things that you have and that you keep with you. And that's why I wanted to reference them in the book, because the book has all of these different things in it that you just can't find online. And when it comes to the stats that came out of it, one of the things that I found most fascinating, because I did co-author this study for the FBI, it was our initial study at the FBI, is that you know, I hear good guy with a gun. I hear get rid of guns. I hear gun-free zones. People have a lot of opinions. They need to have some facts behind the opinions. So when I wrote the chapters, I wrote them thinking, what are the facts, the things that I hear that are wrong? And gave you the citations for where the research says. So for example, in the FBI study that I co-authored, there were 160 incidents that we identified as these exact types of shootings, the same methodology, 160 incidents. In 21 of those, which I'm no mathematician, but my friends who are accountants would tell you, I think is about 13%. And so in 21 of the 160 incidents, unarmed civilians successfully stopped the shooter. So that's a huge percentage, 21 of 160 incidents. How many people with guns who are Joe civilians did that? One. So right now the data doesn't support the concept of carry a gun, run in and shoot somebody who's killing people. Now, I'm telling you that I respect, and I think we need, you know, the idea of law enforcement to be aware in what's going on, trained school resource officers, trained security officers. We do have a lot more guns in the United States, way a lot more guns than we had, you know, back when Sandy Hook occurred, lots more guns. So there are a lot more risks involved, but the data does not in any version support that it is super wise to carry a gun so you can get into a firefight, because there are also as many more situations where people have been killed. Because you don't have, I mean, I spent 20 years trained in law enforcement, and you can't imagine the adrenaline that goes through your body as soon as you pull that gun from your holster. And so for somebody who has never been in that environment and who hasn't trained as much as law enforcement or hasn't trained as much as the FBI, they're going to get tunnel vision right away. They're going to fire all over the place. And we've seen it happen.
To kind of go back to one of the things we started with, some of the data and trends, you referenced the study and how mass shooting, despite kind of all your efforts and all the work that's been done around this, mass shootings are still increasing. What I thought was interesting is that you referenced that the trends for violent crime at times tend to be decreasing.
Yeah.
That
violent crime in the United States is going down.
How does that happen? Why is one going down and they're going up? Explain the trends.
You know, and I think explain the trend now, I'm just drawing on my knowledge. I'm not basing this on statistics, but based on my, working on this for so many years, there are certain aspects. We do have a lot more guns in the United States. Is that responsible for a trend going up? No, because otherwise we'd see more violent crime going up, right? So it's not so much that we have more guns. It's not so much that we have people who are, and your question isn't, what is it not? Your question is, what is it? So let me just maybe answer that question. I think that some of the things that I think of when I think, why are the trends going up and why can't we seem to get our hands on this? I think we live in a world where, 50 years ago, we read one newspaper, and we knew everybody who lived around us, and we knew all the kids that we were in class with, and our community and our world was so much smaller. And now it's so much broader, and because it's so much bigger, because there's all social media and 7,000 channels that you can watch on your cable TV if you don't want to watch one of the streaming services, and because we traverse a lot more, what we have stopped doing is paying attention to the people right next to us. Because 80 to 90% of every shooter in this type of shooting category telegraphs their intent to shoot. And generally, 90% of the time, they're verbally saying something to somebody.
The concept of leakage, I think.
Leakage, right. That's what we call it, leakage. So they're saying, this is what's going on. And they're saying it to people, and people aren't hearing it. And they're not hearing it because of a whole bunch of reasons, right? Sometimes they're not hearing it because they don't want to hear it. You don't want to hear that your child is maybe going down the deep end of the tunnel, or your boss is violent. And people say all the time, and I say this as any law enforcement officer will tell you, every prosecutor who's ever been in court will tell you, when you work criminal cases, people say, he's never done anything like that before. I don't think he would ever do that. I hear that all the time, right? And you hear that while you're interviewing somebody after somebody's been shot. Oh, I can't believe he's done that. He's never done that before. Well, yeah, no kidding. Because if he'd done it before, he'd be in jail, right? So think the logic of it. But people want to believe the best in everybody, right? And I want to believe the best in my kids and my family and my neighbors. But maybe people would think differently if they recognize that in these most violent situations, two things. One is people who commit targeted violence like this, they're on a trajectory towards violence. That's what we call it. So they start out with the idea that they might commit this kind of violence, and then they start planning and preparing for that violence before the violent act occurs. And then that planning and preparation stage, we know from research, that planning and preparation can take days, but more likely weeks, and very often months, and sometimes years. So during that whole time, the people who see them, who are around them, those are the people who can stop this. We can't. Law enforcement, a million law enforcement agents in the United States, officers and agents and sheriff's deputies in the federal, state, local, tribal law enforcement agencies, law enforcement's the last one to know. Peers, teachers, family members, friends, and neighbors. That's who has to get this message. That's why I wrote the book. That's why I do the podcast. Because if you listen to the details of it, you'll begin to hear, oh, I can see that, I can hear that. And you recognize, so the other factor that I wanted to tell you about this, in addition to this trajectory towards violence, is that somewhere in between, depending on how far we look at the research, 35 to 40% of these shooters have the same characteristics, the same behaviors of people who commit suicide because their intent is to commit suicide. So when you think about, I should maybe talk to the police, or I should call an anonymous tip line about my neighbor because I'm not really certain, remember that 35 to 40% of these are suicidal. And if I told you that you should call the police or neighbors about a tip because you thought somebody was going to commit suicide, you'd say, oh yeah, I'll do that. So culturally, we've accepted the idea that even if they don't want us to turn them in or make a call, culturally, we've accepted that we would do that to save somebody from committing suicide. Yet we don't do it for this. And 35 to 40% of these people commit suicide. They go out with the intent to commit suicide. Same behaviors.
Yeah, sort of a cultural shift, right? I mean, when I read the book, I think a lot of people, when they read it, they might think, well, the action items and the steps to end this problem are at the federal level, state level, municipal level. It's my HR department.
I wish it
it's
was.
It's my company. No, it's everyone. You know, if you see something, say something, and the more you wait, the more bad things can happen.
Absolutely. I mean, because I'm such a nerd, when I was flying out here, I was reading this Journal of Threat Assessment Management study, and one of the things, it was on a study about leakage, right, and warnings, and I remember, and I write all over them, right, and one of the things that I remember reading was that they went through research coming in from Oregon to see whether or not how the tip lines, the anonymous tip lines, were being reported. Which is a huge, invaluable source. You don't want to get involved? Call it in. Call it in as a tip, an anonymous tip. That's all we're asking you to do, because we don't know. And in this case, 58% of the people who called in, they were calling in. 58% of the people were calling in something that really had to do with kind of bullying, but a small number of people call in about violence, and they actually, just in the first year of this research in Oregon, they had like 1,000 tips. 58% of them were for bullying and unkind conduct. That's a trajectory conduct. That conduct goes from to saying mean words, to being mean, to bullying. That kind of conduct, we know that people who commit this type of mass violence, targeted violence that is so horrific and terrifies our whole neighborhoods, that half of these people have some level of background that might not be criminal charges, but it's going to be something like bullying or being bullied because, and then they bully back. You know, people have these ideas of who they think a shooter is, and they're all wrong. I think that's one of the things I try to address in the book, is you're looking in the wrong direction.
That's my next question.
Oh, okay, ask away.
Yeah, so you really kind of touched on it. The myths of the mass shooter profile.
Oh,
and the myth that you described was the exact myth, the preconceived notion I came into the book with. It's a white male, social outcast, awkward, quiet, lives in his mother's basement, yada, yada, yada.
Right.
And it's not.
No.
So explain that.
Who
is the mass shooter?
The kid you just described, it's his dad upstairs. It's his dad upstairs watching television after he comes home from work. 35 years old is the average age of a mass shooter like this. 32 years is the mean. Half of these shootings occur in places of business. Only a quarter occur in places of, in educational environments. The places of business are places that are, not just, packing houses and law offices, but day salons and, postal offices and all these other facilities where people go to work every day and they get disgruntled and they start to, I call it, they're called in the industry, we call them the grievance collectors, right? The grievance collectors. And I always say, it's like if you wear a backpack and every time you get mad at somebody, you put another rock in your backpack. And these guys are filling their backpacks up. And I say guys, because that's the only demographic that so far, it's the only demographic that works. When we look at the demographics, the FBI's research over 20 years had, I can't give you the exact number because I don't remember it. And there's so many numbers in my head, but of, 200 and however 70 some shooters over 20 years, 13 were women. So we know that almost all of these are male. That doesn't mean that women don't do them. When they do it, some of them do it with a spouse. And the ones who are the shooters, who are female, generally are they're shooting their place of employment or their former place of employment. So it's all, think about the grievances that you have when you talk about people who are disgruntled employees. One of the facts that when we did the research, my analysts were so not happy with me when I told them, I want you to divide the business shootings into two groups. And they're like, well, they're businesses, we can't. And I said, yes, you can, because you're brilliant. And so you're going to do this. So divide them into places that are where the public circulates, kind of like think about a grocery store or a mall or a big box store or a park, right? But if it's a place of business, does the public transit through that generally, or is it a place where it's not the public? So like a packing house where it's just the employees on site. And when we or a law office, generally just the employees on site, a dentist's office, and it's no just common citizens walking through. When we divided those numbers, it was like a light came on when it came to looking at the research, which was fun for me because that meant that it was worth me asking them to do it. But the value was that it showed us that when a shooting occurs in a place of business, almost virtually every time it is a person who is an employee or was recently employed. And so in the case of this, in the case of the FBI's research, there were 5 people who were fired that day or the day before. Like, so, okay, HR people, how can we stop a shooting if you don't have a policy in place to respectfully help a person leave his employment or her employment? I know that you have a terrible employee and you decide, I want this guy to go, but all you're doing is passing your problem on to somebody else because that guy is picking up a rock and putting it in his backpack. And when he picks up that rock and he puts it in his backpack, sometimes he goes to his car and he gets a gun and comes back. And we've seen that happen many times, too many times. But sometimes it might mean that an employee an employee is taken offline and they give them help to find another job. They give them a couple of extra weeks of pay. The average cost of a worker's comp in this kind of situation is $500,000 for one shooting situation, per person. This is a very expensive, costly endeavor just from a dollar standpoint for businesses. So if most of these shootings occur in businesses, and they're incredibly expensive from a business standpoint. Some estimates I've read, a third of the employees leave a place of employment after a shooting like this. Imagine hiring and retraining a third of your employees. It's business sense. Think about it and put some time and effort into it.
Yeah, and that's not the way that HR departments typically let people go. It's quick, mm-hmm. It's abrupt, and it's cold and sort of by design.
And that's okay. That's okay because that's the way it was done. But I think that's the way it can't be done anymore. I guess mm-hmm. That's kind of my position. It can't be done anymore because we're continuing to see shootings. We're continuing to see them increase in these small areas where we have a very much do not have our fingers on the pulse of who our neighbors are. And then when we do see something, we just look the other way. And everybody who lived through 9/11, I was a terrorism supervisor during 9/11 with the FBI, and see something, say something became our mantra. And we didn't care how many people called us, how many people. But in this study that I was reading about the Oregon tip line and their annual, their stats for a year, 82% of the people reporting were the only ones who reported on that incident. So 82% of the time, there was only a single person reporting on a potential threat or a bullying action, right? So what I'm saying is when you think somebody else will call, you're wrong. When you think maybe I'll call tomorrow, you're wrong. You should call right now and get it off of your shoulders and let the professionals handle it. Because we didn't have, years ago, we didn't have anonymous tip lines everywhere, and now we do. We have phone calls, text messages, safe to tell, see something, say something is on the East Coast. Colorado pioneered it after Columbine. It's not a new thing anymore to have tip lines. Kids can text in the tip, and they do. And the biggest, the most, the largest number of anonymous tips that come in are between 4 p.m. and midnight when kids are home from school, 4 p.m. and midnight. And that's not just about school shootings, right? But that's when people are really active, active online. And they're seeing, hearing, seeing pictures, they're hearing things.
Yeah, speaking of seeing pictures and hearing things, it kind of is a nice segue into the next question.
It's like I set it up or something.
Exactly.
I didn't.
She didn't. But you devote a lot of space in the book to this, and it's something that we've talked about. You know, why is this increase in shootings? And there's, you know, in the last 2-3 decades, there's an increase in media and the way we consume it.
Yeah.
Online, it's constant 24/7 news cycles, social media, texting. It's just constant bombardment of information. It's become packaged. It's almost entertainment in some ways. So you talk about the sort of the contagion effect. And before I stop talking, unless you answer the question, there's a quote in your book that I think kind of sums it up really nicely. Yeah. It's coverage that puts killers in the spotlight makes an implicit promise to those on the edge of committing mass violence. So talk a bit about the contagion effect and how that's driving things.
Yeah, I think when I first started out doing the research, not surprisingly, it takes a long time to write a book that's all fact-based and has lots of studies and research in it. So I was working on the book, I didn't really think about the contagion effect. But, you know, even when I started, there were so fewer shootings, and by the time I finished, there were so many more. And I want to know why, too. And I was doing some digging and some research, and I found out that there was a research project done, Western Australia and Old Dominion here in the United States did a research of after the Sandy Hook shooting. And this is what really caught my interest. They decided to look at 3.5 years of the coverage on ABC World News with David Muir. And this is not picking on ABC. This is saying this is a very legitimate, typical kind of way news coverage is. I live in the Washington, D.C. region. I've been engaged and involved with news media for a long time. They're a well-respected organization. And so 3.5 years of coverage researching the shootings, when ABC News would cover a shooting, and then the researchers looked at when were shootings falling into the same category. When were shootings occurring after the coverage? And they found that in the 4 to 10 days after a shooting, there were 3 more shootings. So they concluded, this is their language, just a back of the envelope calculation, 58% of all shootings that occurred in that 3.5 years could be attributable by cause to the news coverage, 58%. So it's huge numbers. So there was another study that had been done earlier, and it kind of this research validated that research, and that research had said in the 13 days after a shooting, there is an increase in shootings in a 13-day period. So, and actually now what we know, that's one of the things that I think when I was at the Bureau at the FBI, we worked on is asking law enforcement asking the media to think about the way that they cover. And actually, I speak about that specific thing. I was just in Pittsburgh speaking about it. I'm headed out to Springfield, Illinois to speak about it. That very thing is that contagion factor is there. And until we stop giving big coverage and talking and telling the story of the shooter in such a glorifying way, we're not going to get a hold of that, I think.
Yeah, and it seems kind of tough because, and obviously in the modern digital world, you can really measure the response to coverage in real time with internet, with clicks. Story's getting clicks and more clicks. And so it's got to be hard to convince news organizations to go against that tide, right?
That's true. I've had that conversation with producers and with print media, and said, and they say exactly that. They say, some of them say, yeah, we don't. I actually had a fascinating conversation. I have two friends, one who's the editor of a paper in the Midwest and one who works for a major national newspaper that crosses the world. And so I guess you'd probably know who that is. Anyway, so one of the newspaper editors said to me, we have long stood the test of time. We do not glorify the shooters. We use their, try to keep their picture off the front page. We use their name once and only once unless they're at trial. And we believe that if we tell the story of the shooter, that's gonna make other shooters shoot. Perfectly logical and certainly understandable. The other person said, we're a paper of record. We have to use the shooter's name. We feel that we need to do that. Now, I can tell you that the days of the Columbine where we did big documentary features on the shooters, and the front of Time magazine had the Columbine shooters on the front of it, the front of a whole bunch of magazines, those days I think are over, hopefully. I hope they are, and I'll be the one still out there talking to Columbia Journalism Review and others saying, because they're aware of this and they know, they've written themselves about the research that's been done and they need to come up with a standard. You know, I was strolling around today I was down at Holy Name Cathedral, again, nerd. And so they have stuff in the basement that's kind of historical. And there was a story about a priest who was, there's a newspaper clipping up on the wall in a cabinet. And it was a story about a newspaper, a priest who had seen a woman, he'd seen a guy with a purse and he thought that was a little unusual. And he asked the guy about it. And it was, you know, in the 50s or something and 60s. And the guy took off running and it turned out he was a purse snatcher. And the police were there and they happened to catch this guy. The newspaper story had the victim's name and address in it, which would never happen today. It would never happen today. And the same thing, I used to be a journalist 100 years ago, and we wouldn't run the name of a victim of a crime or a rape victim. We don't run a child's name. I think that the newspaper industry, the media industry, the television, they're definitely beginning to get that they need to cover less about the shooter. It's not about the story the shooter wants to tell about himself, because I could talk about that for an hour. You know, they write their own narrative and then everybody covers it. And the people whose stories we should tell always are the people who are dead, who can't tell their story.
Right. I think you talked, there was a story you told in the book about shooter, and prior to the shooting, he had gone out and collected sort of clippings of other previous shooters, right?
Not unusual. I think that a great example is even just Sandy Hook itself. The Sandy Hook shooter had a big chart up on his walls that the police thought took probably a couple of years for him to fill out, detailing all these different shootings. These are not shootings that occur on a moment's notice. That's a different type of violence and a different solution that we have to work on in order to solve that kind of violence. This is targeted violence. That young man who did that at Sandy Hook, it was not unusual. There are other people that we go into theirs. We can track and have sadly tracked our behavioral people at the FBI. Secret Service has done a lot of work on this too, their researchers, analytical teams. And they track people who are fascinated by the Columbine shooters, and they keep lists of them and put it up on their walls and their bedrooms, and they want to be part of that narrative. Even if they don't really fit into it, they want to fit into something. Think about somebody who wants to be in a gang. They want to be in the gang. But in the process of wanting to be in the gang, the guy who runs security, the guy, good way to talk, good Midwestern term, the guy who runs security at the Jefferson County Sheriff's Office, which is where Columbine High School is. He's a longtime friend of mine, and their budget last year, I think, was $6 million for security at the school system, $6 million. And the local law enforcement security that supported them was $4.5 million. So it's $10 million in security because people who admire the Columbine killers come to Columbine to tell a story. They want to be part of that story, even though if you listen to the podcast, she says, plugging it. But honestly, if you listen to the podcast, because I can't do it here, there's so much more detail. The Columbine killers, everything that you think you know about the Columbine killing is wrong. I'm just telling you, everything is wrong. Killers were not bullied, were not part of a trench coat mafia group. And I think that's the thing about the book. There's so much stuff that people don't know and they don't understand. And this, in some ways, is really simple. It's, in some ways, the answer is look at the people around you. Be prepared to see something and say something right now. Look for these behavioral characteristics. They're listed right in the book. They're listed online. You can find them on my website. You don't even have to buy the book, although that's okay. But you know, there's so much information that's out there, but we just don't really look for it and listen for it. And then we create these narratives of people who think that they're the shooters and they want to be like these other shooters.
Right. And we talked a lot about trends and some of the data and profiles and those kind of things, but you know, let's talk a little bit about some of the actionable steps that people can take. And you kind of, and I'll set it up this way, it seems like in your book you kind of broke it down to three main buckets, right? To see something, say something, and then how do you respond in the moment, run, fight, hide, and then kind of the third, stemming the time, you know, stopping the bleeding.
Stopping the bleeding, right. I mean, I think everybody should be trained in how to stop bleeding. I mean, that's life-saving, whether it's a shooting or whether or not it's a car accident or whether you fall off the roof. You know, if you're bleeding out, you're going to bleed out. So everybody can now be trained in that. It's available online, stopthebleed.gov. It's available. You can use tourniquets, all that myth about you shouldn't use a tourniquet, you know, unless you're in the wilds of Alaska, you know, and you can't get to anybody for a long time. But if you're in the wilds of Alaska and you're bleeding out, better to lose a leg, better to lose an arm. So nowadays, tourniquets use is recommended by the American College of Surgeons, which it wasn't previously. So definitely that's for if it happens. Run, hide, fight. Everybody should be trained in that. They should understand what that means, the concepts of it. It's basic human nature to when something bad happens, flight or fright, right? Is that what I'm saying that right? And you run, you hide, or you fight. That's exactly why the federal government, that's why we push that. I push that through over the Department of Education's objection and over, you know, some questions about, is that the right way to teach people in this country? It's the right way to teach people in every country. In England, in the UK, they say run, hide, tell, because they think fight sounds mean. But, you know, but that's okay. I mean, the idea is run or hide. Those are the most important things. Not a lot of people fight, right? But sometimes people do. They fight with their words. I interviewed a woman who spent an hour and a half talking a middle school student into putting the gun down that he had carried into her office on a school day because he was going to shoot up the school. And she used her fight with her words to talk him out of put that gun down. Fights can be a lot of different ways, right? And at Virginia Tech, there were 10 people who barricaded a door and hid behind a door that the shooter was going after and after and after and after and never got through. Virginia Tech, there was a survivor of the Holocaust who was teaching in the engineering program, and he held the door shut, no locks on any of the doors at Virginia Tech in the Norris Hall. He held the door and held the door so the shooter couldn't get through. That was the way he fought. And told his students to jump out the second story windows. And every student except one got out the window before he was shot to death. So he chose to fight. So you can run and you can hide and you can fight. You do all those things. At Columbine, at Sandy Hook, horrible shooting at Sandy Hook where all those little 20 little first graders were killed. A horrible situation in the United States. A teacher in one of the classrooms stood between herself and the students, and six students were able to escape from a side door out into another area and survive because of that. Six students, six bodies, six kids alive today who would not have been alive, but the fact that that teacher stepped in front and distracted and continued to distract. So everybody fights in their own way, but you have to know that you're going to have to do it, and you have to know what your options are. You know, I ramble on, but I'm very passionate sometimes about this. And I just know that there are so many solutions and people don't stop and think about how I can do that. So I guess I didn't really get to how do you prevent it, which is the most important part. So if I could jump.
Yeah, please
okay.
do.
Okay. So because I say that, you know, the book has 14 chapters, 10 of them are about prevention, because it really is about what am I looking for? And then how do I report it and to whom? That's the part that I think that's the part that we fail in miserably. in the United States. We don't know the simple things to look for about people. If we said, what do you look for when somebody's under stress because they might commit suicide? You're already halfway there. You know a lot of those things already. Those are things like you have biggest issues. You have financial troubles. You have mental stress, mental health issues, not mental diagnosis. It doesn't have to be a diagnosis of some mental disorder. You have mental stressors. You have financial troubles. You have interpersonal problems, problems at work. Those are the four biggest factors. We all live with them. We all deal with those all the time. When we find a shooter, when the FBI behavioral people did research on it, they found every person had at least three or four of those stressors that they were dealing with on a daily basis. So look for people who are in financial trouble. Look for people who are struggling with depression and mental health issues, not because you think they're all going to be shooters, because they need help, right? And if they happen to be a grievance collector, they're going to be putting rocks in their backpack. And those aren't even necessarily legitimate grievances. You know, it's like, I'm mad at you because you took my parking spot. And you're like, I was just parking. I didn't even know you were looking for that parking spot. But that guy is putting that rock in his backpack and saying, that's a person I want to get to. Same thing. You don't get promoted. Well, you don't get promoted and you go home and complain about it and have a beer with your friends. The other guy doesn't get promoted. He goes out to his car and gets a gun and comes back in. So the people that you're around are the ones who, the people around you are the ones who are going to say things. And you have to listen for those things and that conduct. You really have to trust your spidey senses. That's really what it comes down to. You know when your kid's in the other room and it gets really quiet, right? You're like, something's up. When you're standing in working at the office and then all of a sudden you kind of, what's going on? And you look around and there's somebody down at the other end of the room staring down the hallway at you. That little spidey sense, it's the same thing. You got to report those things right now. Because you know what? If you report them, people say, I don't want to get anybody in trouble. I don't want to get involved. I don't think that he's really going to do anything. He's never done that before, right? Those are crappy reasons. I'm just telling you, when it's life and death, those are crappy reasons. Take the information off of the burden of your shoulders and put it in the hands of the professionals who hear tips, 1,000 tips a day, 100 tips at that police department every day. They listen, they can weigh it. The school threat assessment teams, the university threat assessment teams, they can weigh the information. And they may have information you don't know anything about. And I tell you, that is a longtime FBI agent. Somebody calls us with one little tiny piece of information, and then we have like, oh my gosh, that's like the other piece of the puzzle we didn't know anything about. You don't know what other puzzle pieces are on the table. So if you don't call, you're not being a very good citizen. You're not being a very good person who is interested in saving the lives of people, even though you want to be. So it's okay to call. Law enforcement's not going to run out and knock on somebody's door and arrest them because somebody called and said, hey, I think this guy is acting kind of hinky. It doesn't work that way. I mean, it doesn't work that way in the United States, I'll tell you that.
Yeah, sort of like we got to create this culture of feeling free and open enough to kind of do those things and sort of breaking down those barriers. And as a former attorney and someone who's now in sort of the legal technology space, privacy comes into play for me. Sure. And that was one thing that I was thinking about while reading that. And of course, you immediately touched on it by addressing, HIPAA and state privacy laws and said, it's not really a concern. It doesn't really touch that.
Yeah.
So put that.
Yeah. Actually, like when you think about private state privacy laws, federal privacy laws, HIPAA, federal HIPAA, FERPA, which is for education, privacy laws, every state has privacy laws. You have standards in your own business. The schools have standards. What is the safest way to protect you when you provide information to somebody from a assault on your privacy, like that you violated my privacy rights? The safest way to do that is to report something to the police, because there are law enforcement exceptions in every one of those laws. If there is a belief that from law enforcement, based on information they receive, that there could be a threat to life, privacy goes out the window. If there could be a threat to life, and it should. I mean, I'm going to go through a door because I'd rather, as an agent, as an FBI agent, I'd rather have you sue me than me have somebody behind the door get killed.
Sure. Can you think of any sort of examples of a school or a business who's really implemented a reporting system that is incredibly effective? Everyone's sort of bought in. Have you seen that kind of happen, or is no one really quite there yet?
That's a good question. Okay, so here's what I would say. There are, since Columbine, there's no question that Safe to Tell out in Colorado has stepped up and been the center of attention for how to do that. You can look at Safe, S-A-F-E, with the number two, Tell, T-E-L-L. Safe to Tell, it's an anonymous reporting system, but there are anonymous reporting systems all over the United States now that you can, that fall into place. A friend of mine runs See Something, Say Something anonymous reporting system that's supported by the efforts that happened after Sandy Hook, for instance, and the whole state of Pennsylvania just signed on to that. This Oregon study that I was reading is because they created a tip line and then they wanted to know the validity of it. And so there are tip lines available all over the United States. I'm in Chicago right now. There's a phone number you can call that I don't have memorized, but it's 1-877 something, 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 right? And that's a phone number you can call for anonymous tips. Every state has them. You just have to look them up. And I will tell you this in a backup category. Every single person can call the FBI's tip line and talk to a real person or fill out something online and get that information. And if the FBI gets a tip, and I'm going to tell you, because I can hear the naysayers, it's not a perfect system. I mean, there are balls that have been dropped. And yes, I recognize what happened down in Florida. But if you called the FBI tip line because you're in Connecticut, and you heard about something, you saw some picture that your cousin posted on Facebook, whatever, making stuff up here, and it involved something, and you were afraid that there was a threat on a school in San Francisco, the FBI would get on the phone and talk to the San Francisco school. They'd pass that information along. And if they called local law enforcement, they do the same thing. Law enforcement can call to law enforcement all the time, and Colorado has done a really great job with that. They're the forefront of teaching kids, they're at the forefront of teaching kids sensitively, not scaring any kids. By far, Colorado is way ahead of that because they have suffered so many shootings in that area, and they're in such a concentrated area.
Well, thank you very much, Catherine Schweit, for being here. The book is Stop the Killing, How to End the Mass Shooting Crisis. And thank you, everyone, for coming, and thank you for being here.
It's my pleasure. I appreciate the opportunity. Thanks.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the AWM Author Talks podcast. Next week, WXRT radio host Terry Hemmert sits down with acclaimed singer-songwriter Joan Osborne to discuss songwriting, Bob Dylan, and more. Now go, be inspired, and find the mind of a writer in yourself.